the title. The title of the talk tonight is Five Kinds of Happiness. It's actually Five Kinds of Happiness Part One. It's going to be more than one talk, I'm sure. And actually, the talk was generated. I'm planning to offer a long series once again. I did this once before. I'm working with difficult emotions, working with difficult and sometimes called destructive emotions. And as I was studying that and contemplating it, there are just so many different pieces that are important to understand when we start to think about emotion and how we work with it. It's useful to have some sense of the construction of the self. It's useful to have some sense of wise effort. And it's useful to have some sense of, well, what is wholesome? If we want to think about whether emotions are wholesome or unwholesome, it's useful to kind of have some sense of what's the context in which we're speaking. So I, as usual, got a little carried away. I'm leading toward an inquiry into working with difficult emotions, but at the moment, speaking to happiness and the wholesome, and trying to set some context for working with the difficult. Emotions, I have discovered, I didn't realize this, emotions actually have no singular definition. Not even among, there's so many neuroscientists who are studying emotion. And if you look carefully, I came across a chart that had about 12 or 15 different sets of definitions of what emotions are among the very top scientists who are studying them. So that's just in the Western psychology, and then if we start to compare Western psychology to Buddhist psychology, things get sticky rather quickly. In Western psychology, depending on who you talk to, there are primary emotions. Sort of, you know, people have compared them to primary colors, you know, like red, blue, green, yellow. And that the primary emotions are sort of the ones that kind of get stirred together with one another to make all different kinds of both wholesome and unwholesome mind states. And primary emotions are anger. Well, this is according to Paul Ekman, you know, one person. Anger, anxiety, surprise, confusion, surprise, sadness, disgust, and happiness. And you notice that there's a little bit of an imbalance there, that there's like five of these and one of those. And Rick Hansen, when he comes, he'll probably mention that the human mind has a tendency to really land more solidly on negative emotions, and it makes sense. And I know many of us have noted that as we've spoken. It makes sense, actually, just biologically, that it's better to make a mistake by being too negative and running away or fighting than it is to make a mistake and be too positive and get eaten. You know, so in terms of evolution, that our human brain actually, as I understand it, actually registers the negative much more quickly and much more easily than registering the positive. But when we think about working with emotion, we actually need to cultivate a sense of working with what is wholesome. Because otherwise, it really doesn't make any sense. It sort of devolves, I think, into a sort of list of commandments, you know, about how we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to take all these energies and, you know, contain them and not act them out in unwholesome ways. And it gets kind of tight and restrictive. And just ends up being a list, I think, a list of rules about how to be. So it's helpful to hold the inquiry in the sense of what do we mean by what is by wholesome? And indeed, what do we mean by happiness? And you've heard me say many times, the Buddha actually invited us in our inquiry into wisdom to really inquire in sort of three ways. One is more conceptual, just hearing the teachings, reading things. And it's the thing that we do when we listen to talks or study or read books or, you know, whatever it is we do, to try to understand what is the Buddha teaching, what are the teachings. But he said if it stays at a conceptual level, it's really not of much use. That the invitation actually is to start to reflect. Really, what does this mean? That's where I got myself in trouble when I started, actually about a year ago, to really study emotion again in earnest. I've done this before, but to kind of revisit it. You know, I started to reflect and you know, I don't know anything at all about this. As I started to reflect and really began to see some of my own confusion and some of the questions. How does this really work? One of the things, for example, that has always puzzled me, and in some ways still does, it's like, well, if emotion, if all of these things, if anger and disgust and anxiety and fear, if they're just part of our animal nature, then how is it that we can even talk about them not being wholesome? Aren't they sort of automatically wholesome if it's just part of who we are? And how do we navigate that? So anyway, I started to think along those lines, and hopefully we'll be able to kind of offer some thoughts about that as we go along. But so the second layer, anyway, is reflecting. How does this really work? And what does it mean, actually, when you say, well, you know, the Buddha sometimes really is very graphic about talking about working with hatred or anger, but then, well, what about self-esteem, and what about boundaries, and, you know, what about dealing with people who are unkind? You know, how do we do that? How do we come to think about that? So we begin to reflect and really begin to see, A, where the questions are, and B, what's true. And then the third layer is the direct experience. We look to see what's arising directly in our experience, what we do actually when we sit in our meditation practice. And you know, I invite you to look and see, what's your experience of the breath? Not what's the concept of how the breath is or the fact that you're breathing, you know, not what you think, but what's the direct experience? What do you notice about this? So really kind of three layers as we kind of settle into deeper and deeper wisdom and deeper understanding. So if we think about what is happiness, I wanted to ask you to reflect on that for a minute. What is happiness? Is it external? Is it internal? How do you know if you're happy? And if you like, just take a couple minutes. Some of you may like to, some of you may not. And just turn to whoever is sitting near you and just share some thoughts, or maybe just share some questions that arise in that reflection. If you don't want to, then just don't. You know, just, you know, continue to reflect on your own. But if anybody would like to just kind of share with somebody sitting near you, just take a couple minutes and do that. So again, the invitation is to begin to reflect, and I would invite you to take that reflection home with you during the week, and maybe talk with other people. What is happiness? What is wholesome? What is the wholesome? What is happiness? The Buddha says, or the Dalai Lama says, the purpose of life is to be happy. Well, what does that mean? The other thing that you might reflect on is, what's your own personal story about happiness? Or rather, what's your own personal story about your own happiness? You know, that you will be happy when, or if, or you can't be happy because, or until. You know, it can be useful to reflect on, what's your story about happiness? Useful to think about that. A couple quotes, but I want to read you a couple quotes, but don't let those intimidate you or change your own reflection just for whatever is useful. Matthew Ricard, who is a Western monk, he says, by happiness here, I mean a deep sense of flourishing that arises from an exceptionally healthy mind. This is not a mere pleasurable feeling, a fleeting emotion or a mood, but an optimal state of being, leading to a sense of release, a deep calm, free of all expectation and fear. Pretty impressive. Happiness is also a way of interpreting the world, since while it may be difficult to change the world, it is always possible to change the way we look at it. Rick Hansen, the psychologist who Ali said is actually coming here in a couple of weeks, he talks about happiness arising when we are calm, contented, caring, and creative. Sort of the balance, or creative being kind of the balance of those first three, calm, contented, and caring. And neuropsychologist Dan Siegel speaks of being flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. You know, so that when he talks about when something comes together in a way that is flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. He uses the example, which I really like, of a cloud. You know, here's this cloud. It's kind of, it's not like a thing that you can put in a box and give her a Christmas present, but it comes together. In a way that's flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. So he talks about us as people in much the same way, or our brains in much the same way. You know, this state of coming together in a way that is balanced. He also talks about being balanced. I keep using this this image. He says, you know, that there's sort of at one end, there's a place of rigidity where you're not flexible, where you're kind of stuck and caught. And then at the other end, where there's so much data that you're really kind of lost in chaos. And so this flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable is, you know, in that middle place, someplace where there's this sort of kind of capacity to respond in a wholesome way. And I'm going to propose, and I will propose as I talk over the weeks, that happiness then is a state of coherent integration. So some sense of, I love that image of the cloud. So some sense of being integrated, kind of all the different parts are kind of working together in a coherent way. Wholesome, unwholesome energies and emotion, mind-body states that either promote or interfere with clear discernment, internal coherence, flexibility, and relational attunement. So happiness is kind of being in that kind of a state where things kind of work coherently. And the different levels of happiness, I will propose, have to do with what's the kind of, how to describe it? Well, this is a bit circular. I'll try to explain it more as we go along. But sort of like there can be different levels of coherence, if you will. They're sort of on a physical level, on an emotional level, on a much more spacious spiritual level. There can be different kind of levels of coherence, sort of like different layers of the ocean, you know, that we can get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper coherence. And so one of the ways that we can understand emotion, different kinds of emotion, oh, never mind, I'm not going to go there, it's too confusing. Stay tuned. This is Matthew Ricard again. He says, so long as we are slaves to the dissatisfactions and frustrations that arise from the confusion that rules our minds, it will be just futile to tell ourselves, I'm happy, over and over. The search for happiness is not about looking at life through rose-colored glasses or blinding oneself to the pain and imperfection of the world. Nor is happiness a state of exaltation to be perpetuated at all costs. It is the purging of mental toxins, such as hatred and obsession, that literally poison the mind. It is also about learning how to put things in perspective and reduce the gap between appearances and reality. The Buddha says, the gladness connected to the wholesome I call an equipment of mind for overcoming ill will and hostility. And that's kind of why I think about really talking about happiness before we work with ill will and hostility. Because the Buddha says, you know, this quality of mind and heart is an equipment of mind. It's the space in which we need to work if we're going to work with and pay attention to what Matthew Ricard is calling some toxins, some interferences, if you will. That if we don't understand that it's interfering with something else, then it gets really kind of sticky and really confusing. Wise effort, the Buddha tells us, is to prevent the arising of unwholesome states that deter that kind of calm and clarity and coherence, to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. And I don't know about you, when I think of difficult or destructive emotions, I tend to think mainly in terms of those first two kinds of wise efforts, you know, to abandon, you know, to release unwholesome states that have arisen, to prevent the arising of unwholesome states. But it's important to remember that there are two other aspects of wise effort: to arouse unarisen wholesome states, and to maintain wholesome states that already have arisen, bringing them by attention and practice to full development. So once again, I want to talk about difficult emotions. I want to talk about them over time in the context of the arisen wholesome states. How do we cultivate wholesome states? What do we mean by a wholesome state? And how do we maintain wholesome states when they are arisen? And those are the equipment of mind for dealing with the difficult or the destructive. So it really kind of begins to kind of settle. It's like, oh, so when the Buddha says, you know, to cultivate the wholesome, or when the Dalai Lama says the purpose of life is to be happy, you know, it's sort of, oh, it's like, okay, to cultivate these wholesome states, for me to cultivate these wholesome states is exactly what our practice is about. And that's the equipment of mind for dealing with the difficult. So calm, contented, caring, flexible, coherent mind. That's a place where Western psychology and Buddhist psychology kind of meet and shake hands, if you will. From a Western perspective, from a perspective of Western psychology, wholesome states would be the capacity to process information, the billions of sense impressions in any given moment, and to organize and regulate experience and action in a way that leads to coherent and balanced internal and external functioning. To know, to tolerate, to modulate, and to communicate both pleasant and unpleasant experience in relationship. So from a Western perspective, we're talking about basically how we balance this thing up here and balance the relationship of the brain and the body, and then balance the relationships of this organism with you, with one another, from a Western perspective. From a Buddhist perspective, from an Eastern perspective, wholesome states go even further. They allow us to see reality deeply and fully as it really is, like a cloud, insubstantial, always changing, determined by infinite causes and conditions out of our immediate control and impersonal, not reflective of our personal self. So wholesome states from a Buddhist perspective actually kind of dives, if you will, to a deeper layer of the ocean. But one of the things that we can get confused about is that we can think in our practice that we're supposed to just dive to that deeper layer, and that some of the kind of more surface layers don't matter or are irrelevant or should be just sort of discarded. And so when I talk about five kinds of happiness, I want to propose that that's not really true. It's just like we just keep widening, 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 or deepening, deepening, deepening the capacity for stronger and deeper and more profound kinds of happiness. But it doesn't mean that those kind of more, if you will, surface kinds of happiness are not relevant and important. This is Nyanaponika Thera. He says, life, though full of woe, holds also sources of happiness and joy unknown to most. Let us teach people to seek and to find real joy within themselves and to rejoice with the joy of others. Let us teach them to unfold their joy to ever sublimer heights. Noble and sublime joy is not foreign to the teaching of the enlightened one. Wrongly, the Buddhist teaching is sometimes considered to be a doctrine-diffusing melancholy. Far from it, the Dhamma leads step by step by step to an ever purer and loftier happiness. So that's what we're talking about. The gladness connected to the wholesome, I call an equipment of mind for doing all that. So in order to speak well of working with difficult emotions or destructive or unwholesome emotions, it's important that we rest this inquiry in an understanding of what the wholesome is. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. So the invitation, too, is to start where we are. Not to try to get someplace, but to start where we are. Ayakima has a wonderful teaching called, she has an essay in one of her books. I've actually talked about it before. It's called Four Kinds of Happiness. And if you're interested, you can actually Google Ayakima. It's A-Y-Y-A-K-H-E-M-A. Four Kinds of Happiness. And you'll get a YouTube talk. It'll pop up a talk. It's not, you won't get the written copy of her talk, but you'll get her talk on four kinds of happiness. And each of the kinds of happiness that she's talking about offers a different, like a different layer, a different level. So again, to kind of really kind of know that the invitation at any given moment is to kind of see where you are. What's the level that you're working with? And what's the level that maybe somebody that you're talking to is working with? And it doesn't mean that once you've kind of done this level, then okay, fine, you're finished with that. That we just are constantly kind of circling back and forth at these different levels. And sometimes we try to get to a deeper level before we really have kind of cultivated an earlier level. And the image that I came up with is sort of like trying to pick your flowers, or your daffodils before they open, or your tomatoes before they're ripe. You know, that the invitation really is to look and see, where are we? Start where you are. What's really needed here? So the first level that Ayakema talks about is it's just simple sensory happiness. And again, it can be a bit of a surprise. Sometimes we can think of our Buddhist practice as you're supposed to kind of let go of, you know, sensory happiness as kind of unimportant or trivial. And she talks about the level of really letting ourselves tune into the simple goodness of sensory happiness. And the invitation, as always, is to, again, I do this thing that Dan Siegel offers, is to kind of really kind of bring awareness up to notice sensory happiness. Sometimes we can be kind of dull and kind of lethargic and not really notice it, or we can have a habitual pattern of being caught in that negative loop that Rick Hansen talks about. But to kind of bring awareness up to notice the goodness of sensory happiness without moving into a state of kind of chaotic grasping. More, more, more. Can we really cultivate the capacity to simply enjoy sensory happiness? When we started the meditation, I invited you to tune into a quality of goodness of just simply sitting. Or just feeling the quality of your clothing. I would invite you about 5 more minutes of the talk, but I would invite you to take as some homework the invitation to let yourself open to the experience of ordinary sensory happiness. I thought of doing this and then I realized I wouldn't have time. I was going to just take a few moments and just ask you to go do something, like go to the washroom or look at what's at the table or whatever. But to have the practice be an awareness of any quality of sensory happiness or sensory pleasure. And to really let yourself feel that fully in the physical body. So when you're looking at the daffodils, you know, you drive down the road, you look at the daffodils, they're in the garden. It's like, oh yeah, right, the daffodils are blooming. To really pause and tune into the body, noticing again, can you bring awareness up to experience that without going into, oh, and there are more over there, there are more over there, is it possible to kind of simply let yourself know sensory happiness? I was, for some reason, just really noticing, just walking around in my stocking feet at home and just feeling just how good the floor felt. Goodness, goodness. And really letting ourselves take in that goodness. It's a quality of wise effort, cultivating the wholesome, really feeling the nourishment that brings to our coherent state of mind. That enables us to kind of really come into a quality of greater balance, greater ease. So noticing pleasant experiences or positive experiences that are already present. Maybe in the foreground, maybe in the background. I invited you in the meditation to kind of look to see, is there anything that's pleasant that might be in the background? that you have maybe an ache in your shoulder, but maybe if you kind of look a little more deeply, there's something else. Can that be known also? Noticing what's not wrong. And really letting yourself be nourished by that. Noticing the taste of your food. Really letting yourself be nourished by that goodness. You can do it a little bit more mentally even, what's going well in your life. I was feeling kind of down the other day, and in my sitting practice, I realized that I, you know, was going to be sitting, and I was feeling kind of logy and depressed, and I decided to, instead of bringing awareness to that, to bring awareness, I was thinking about a person who, in my past, who I knew loved me. I just knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that he loved me. And just letting myself feel for the whole meditation period that goodness. How does it feel in the body? Where is it in the body? Can the breath really nourish and support that? Noticing what's wrong. What have you recently accomplished? What feels good? Sometimes we can be so preoccupied with what's next that we don't pause to really appreciate. Oh, I did that. Good for me. What are you grateful for? There are limits, of course, to this kind of happiness. It can be difficult to stay balanced. You've heard me say, we asked Shinzen Young one time, is it possible to be liberated by working with just pleasure? And he said, yes, it's just much harder. Because the tendency is to get out of balance. It's sort of like, you know, when you taste the goodness of your food. I've noticed sometimes, you know, you feel the goodness of the food, and then there's this kind of almost voracious kind of desperate wanting for more of it, you know. So it can be a bit of a challenge. We can become preoccupied making that the goal. We can try to keep it and make it permanent when it isn't. Actually, if sense contacts, even pleasant ones, were permanent, they would very quickly turn into the unpleasant. You know, you think about some music that you really love. And then you know that if you were imprisoned by the Taliban, that they would play that over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. You know, that just even the pleasant becomes unpleasant if it is just, you know, relentless. We can also, without reflection, delight in things that are quite unskillful. You know, we can kind of really, you know, kick the cat or say unskillful words and really take momentary pleasure when it's really not so wholesome. So the question, this is from one of my teachers, Gregory Kramer. He says, is this delight? He says, is it preventing a touching of the vastness, or is it a pathway to the mystery and the vastness and the goodness? And so you can ask yourself that question when you notice this kind of sensory delight. Is this a pathway to the mystery and the goodness of life? He says, if we don't include this, the austerity of practice can lead to a rejection of life. I'm looking to see, what is it that I need now? And I'll close with a poem by Mary Oliver. The title of her poem is Mindful. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It was what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. So for a bit of homework, should you like to do some, I would invite you to investigate the prayers made out of grass. Mary talks about the dull, the drab, the daily presentations. To not only notice them with your conceptual mind, but to reflect, to really bring them into your reflection, and then to drop into experience. And really allow yourself to notice in the body the goodness connected with the wholesome that the Buddha calls the equipment of mind. So you can develop your own equipment. So, blessings.